Okay, sorry about that. It's good to be here. Jim, thank you. Thank you, everybody who's here. My name is Dan Cotter, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July the 13th of 1979. I'd like to start out with a story. Actually, I'll probably tell a lot of stories through this meeting this morning because that's the way I'm able to communicate. I think it's part of the Irish in me. Anyway, I'm riding a bus in downtown Chicago after I was sober for a few years, and I ran into a friend of mine who said he was starting a new meeting, a men's meeting, and that he would like to have me join it. And it's for people, men who were sober 10 years or more. And I said, well, I'm not 10 years sober. I'm only whatever it was, 8 or 9 years at the time. And he said, okay, but when you get to 10 years, come on, we're over at this church he mentioned. And I thought, no, I'm not going to join that. And I got into my alcoholic elitist role and thinking that, why just men and all that. When in truth, I was afraid of being with men alone. I operated real well with women, but I couldn't operate too well with men. I thought they'd see through me. And I was always sort of afraid of that. I talked to my sponsor about this after a while, and I finally got to 10 years, and I took a deep breath, and I joined that meeting. And it was good for me. It absolutely opened up a part of me that had been closed like a clam before. And when the Zoom started, or pa pandemic started, I'm sorry, and Zoom meetings started taking over, Stephen Todd and I were talking, and he mentioned that he attended this meeting, this Men Who Trudge meeting, where it didn't have the word, the title then, but every day and on Sunday. Well, I can't attend the 7:30 in the morning meetings, but I can attend a Sunday morning meeting. And so I tuned into you guys, and you have opened another part of my life. I love this meeting. It's part of my weekly sobriety checklist of things I need to do to be proof and to be spiritually fit. And I feel that way about this meeting and the way I was welcomed as only a day hop on Sunday. So I thank you for that. I drank for 22 years. So I'm going to probably talk this morning more about the gifts of the program, the 22 years that I haven't been drinking, than the 22 years that I did drink. Actually, my drunkalogue is sort of boring. It's not too exciting. So I'll start with my family. I'm the oldest of four children, two boys and two girls. My parents, neither one of them were drunkards. They didn't drink very often, certain occasions. I was born in Duluth, Minnesota, and in the early days after the US joined the Second World War, my father moved the family from Duluth to Chicago, the Chicago area. So I really grew up, and most of my adult life was in Chicago, and that's where I did a lot of my drinking, and that's where my sobriety started. I was brought up by loving parents. My father was pretty strict. If you would think, I was born in 34. And in those years, they were just recovering from the depression. Corporal punishment was still a way of guiding children. And I got plenty of that, but nothing that I think is untold of, and certainly not abuse. I was also a loner. I remember when we were still living in Duluth, I would go next door to the house of a couple that had a couple older boys, and they would let me play with their toys. These kids were gone. They were out of the house. So I played in the attic with those toys all by myself and really enjoyed myself. And it came out late, way later in some psychology sessions that I did enjoy being by myself. And being a loner, I chose sports that were loner sports. I worked in a warehouse. My father was in the hardware business, And I worked in, with him, went down on Saturdays and on the weekends and that kind of stuff. And the only thing he'd trust me to do was to work in the office, in the warehouse, putting stock away. And I met a guy named Vito Rizzo. And Vito Rizzo had a cousin named Joey Michelli. And Joey Michelli was a ranked middle welterweight boxer in the Chicago area. And Vito used to take me with him to the gym. And I became interested in boxing, and I was never very good, but I boxed through college on that, and even boxed in the Golden Gloves, but only made it to my second bout before I got knocked out. My other love was racing. For my eighth grade graduation present, my father took me to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway race, the 500, on May 30th of 1949, and I fell in love with racing. And in those days, I was a preteen or just an early teenager. My father gave me a lot of license to go around, and we used to have races in Soldiers Field. Yep, where the Bears play now, there used to be a racetrack in there, and I would take a bus and an L and a streetcar to Soldiers Field and jump over the wall and put a rag in my pocket and then find somebody who needed help and push a race car or get water for them, whatever. And there'll be more of that in my later story. But racing became a very important part of my life. A not very important part of my life in the loaner department was the fact that I was a window peeper. I don't know if you call that a sport, but I think I made one out of it. My first drink was in grade school. I don't really remember it. I know I was with a couple of guys and we got a liquor bottle out from under the sink at my parents' house. And I had a drink of it. We all had a drink of it. And it was no big event. I did not get sick. I did not think it would taste very good. And my next drink was not until I was in college. I didn't drink through high school. I didn't have hang with guys that drank through high school. And as I said, I was pretty much of a loner. And racing took me away from the guys that did the stick and ball sports. So I was pretty much on my own. And drinking wasn't any part of my life until I got to, as I said, college. Went to Marquette in Milwaukee, which is a good place to break into drinking. And I ended up dating a girl that, well, I think she was a sophomore or a junior. And one Friday afternoon, she invited me to go with her to meet some
Oh.
friends over at this bar. And
Hold
I
on.
went to it and I had my first
I
beer.
can't hear you.
And
Yeah.
I can't say that it caused me any great difficulty. It didn't at all. But it did change the way I felt about myself. It did change the way that I fit into that group or thought I fit into that group. And it did fit the fact that I thought my sweater matched my pants, stuff like that. But it didn't take over my life. I drank through a great through college. And one of the big things we did that had a lot of breweries there, and every Friday afternoon, a brewery would open up and give free beer if you did a tour. And I remember by my senior year, I could give the tours, and we knew found a shortcut to go from the entrance right into the lounge. We didn't even have to do the tour. But and I got drunk a couple of times, but it wasn't any really big deal. Progression started though when I went to grad school. I was graduated from Marquette in 1959. And I went to Northwestern Grad School in downtown Chicago and lived in a dorm down there. And there, I think my buddies and I thought we were above other people. And we started drinking hard liquor. And slowly, liquor began to take effect in my life. Almost flunked me out of grad school. It did start affecting the fact that I'd have hangovers in the morning. And drink was gradually becoming more and more a part of my life. When I was in grad school, I met my wife to be. She was an undergraduate at Northwestern. She's from outside of New York City. Diana and I were married. She was a wonderful woman. And I need to tell you a story of our honeymoon. We went away on our honeymoon, And on the second or third day that we were on the beach where we were down in the Caribbean, we ran into an older couple, and they introduced me to some kind of vodka or something that was in a bullion. And I got absolutely hammered. And I know I passed out on the floor of our room in the hotel, and Diana didn't know what to do with me. So she squirted toothpaste into my mouth, thinking that I needed to clean up my breath. The point of this story is I couldn't brush my teeth with toothpaste for 4 or 5 days, but the next day I could drink again. I could have liquor. And, is that a signal that there were dark days ahead of me? I would think so, but that's just part of my story. After we were married and back home, and I'm finished with graduate school. I started to go to law school and didn't last very long there because my job was sort of taking precedence there. But really, what was taking precedence was drinking. I was drinking secretly, and I didn't have to because Diana, she was taught by her mother that there's a lot of competition out there, and when your husband comes home, meet him with a drink, be dressed up, that kind of thing. And she did. We drank in the home, and I always drank more than her. We had two daughters in fairly quick succession, and I forgot to say another part of this. Not only did I drink secretly, but I was pretty much of an alley cat. I was unfaithful to Diana. I was not very, very proud of myself. There was this degradation that drink brings upon you, but there was also me. I'm responsible for that. So my morals were pretty much that of an alley cat. We got divorced, and it was not Diana's will to get divorced. It was my will to get divorced because in the back of this alcoholic mind, I thought she was stultifying my drinking. And if I got divorced, I could drink more freely. By that time, we had three daughters, and I would get an apartment, small apartment somewhere, and I would take my kids out. I had visiting privileges. I tried to, even in my drunkenness, tried to be good to Diana and to these kids, but also it was all about me. And I'll tell a story that I'm not proud of at all, but exemplifies the self-centeredness of an alcoholic named Dan Cotter. I would have these privileges and take the kids out for weekends or different visits to areas around the city. We lived downtown Chicago. We were fairly close to the Lincoln Park Zoo. Those of you that know Chicago, it's a beautiful zoo in Lincoln Park along the lake. And one Sunday, I took my kids out. We walked down to the zoo. We were in the children's zoo, and I had to have a drink. So I told them to stay there in the zoo. At that time, Chicago had some blue laws, and they couldn't serve liquor on Sundays until, I don't know, if it was either noon or 1 o'clock. And I knew where there was a bar about 3 blocks from where I left these kids. And I went over there and I was the first one in line to get a drink. I had a couple of drinks and went back. And through the goodness of God, those three kids were still in that zoo. But if in these days, if you heard about that, I would be in the slammer for doing that, and I should be. But that's the self-centeredness of Dan's alcoholism at the time. I didn't know anything about AA. As I said, my parents weren't drinkers. They drank once in a while. And I didn't ever hear about AA. But I did belong to the board of a boys' club that was near our warehouse in Chicago, downtown Chicago. And one noontime, we used to have Friday noon, once a month, meetings there for the board. And I'm standing around and we didn't have booze at these meetings because it was a boys' club, but we're standing around talking before we had our luncheon meeting. And over my shoulder, I heard a guy named Wally talking to someone else about the fact that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a hangover that day, and that bit of information hung in my mind. And although I didn't take him up and talk about AA with him at the time, I did have that first touch of God saying, here is where you can find some help. I think it took me about a year to give Wally a call and say, Wally, I think I may have a drinking problem and I could use your help. He turned me over to a guy by the name of Bill C. In Chicago, who was a little bit closer to my age. I had lunch with Bill and I didn't like anything about Bill. I think Bill at that time was 6 or 7 years sober. He had a responsible job downtown in Chicago, but he would, yeah, I don't know what it was. I had some excuses like for that first men's meeting, you know, it was all me about something wrong. And I really had nothing to do with this guy for quite some time, but I was having a deteriorating health problem. I would get an annual physical, and the doctor that would be giving me this physical says, your liver enzymes are out of whack, and you got this, and you're overweight, and your blood pressure is high. And I said, okay, I'll cut down on my drinking. And this doctor is the one who said, if you think you can cut down on your drinking, how about not drinking for 2 weeks and come back and see me? And I went out of there thinking, I can do that. I can do anything for 2 weeks. So I didn't drink for 2 weeks. Went back to him. My blood pressure was a little lower. You know, I don't know about my enzymes, but I think there was progress there. And he said, see, I think it's your drinking. Cut down on your drinking. Well, I didn't, as you would guess. And a year later, I went back to the same doctor. And this time I was drinking in the morning, or by this time I was drinking in the morning. And as he was examining me, he said, hey, when did you have your last drink? And I made up some story about a convention being in town, and I probably drank about 2 o'clock in the morning, when in fact I drank for the nerve to go over to see him. And he said, well, your breath smells just like the Bowery bums I used to treat when I was in New York med school. That was like a cold steel put into my gut, but it didn't keep me from drinking. But a couple of weeks later, I went back to him and I asked him for some help. I said, you know, I do think I have a problem with drinking. He said, I can't help you, or I don't think I can help you, but I have a psychiatrist friend who you can make an appointment with, and he may be able to help you because he does treat people with drug and alcohol problems. So I made an appointment, went to the psychiatrist, spent an hour with him, made an appointment, went back the next week. He looks at me and he said, you know, I don't think I can help you. I think you're an alcoholic. I don't think you're crazy. And guys, I wanted to be crazy because I knew I could take a pill for being crazy. But I knew enough that, and very little I did know about alcohol, is that it was going to take more work than if I was just nuts. And I was nuts. That's the insanity of it all. So I asked him, okay, what do I do? And he said, make an appointment over at Grand Hospital. That was a local hospital in the area. He said, they have a good drug and alcohol program. I'd make an appointment for an evaluation, which I did. I made an appointment, and on Labor Day of 1977, I sat down with a very attractive young woman and spent an hour with her. About half that time I was trying to get in her pants, and the other half the time I was lying to her. And I didn't get any satisfaction on either one of those counts because she has said, Mr. Cotter, I don't know what you are or who you are, but I suggest that you go to a meeting tonight and see if you might hear something that touches you. And I said, where would I find this meeting? She said, right here in this hospital at 7 o'clock tonight. So I went to the meeting thinking that maybe she was trying to make a date with me, but couldn't make a date during the office hours, and she would meet me at this meeting. Well, she never showed up, but I did run into a guy with tattoos sitting on the edge of a table with a booming voice named Bill, who said, hi, my name is, he actually yelled, hi, my name is Bill, I'm an alcoholic. That's a guy I probably wouldn't even drink with. Yet he welcomed me to an AA meeting. That's not the point. The point is that there were about, I don't know, 75 people at that meeting in the auditorium of this hospital. There was a little guy, I call him a Sammy Davis Jr. clone, that was talking, gave the lead. He spent his entire lead talking to a switchblade at the side of the room, never made eye contact with anyone. With my arrogance, I criticized all that. But I did hear something. I heard him talk about a guy. He talked about the third step. I didn't know anything about the third step, but he did talk about a God. And the God he talked about was 180 degrees different than the God I hauled in that room. He talked about a loving, caring God who actually would take care of me if I asked for help. Excuse me. He talked about a God that was there all the time, a God that had his back. I didn't stay dry from that night, but I did have a picture of a God implanted in my head by this little guy that I never lost. I also never saw this fellow again that talked about this. I spent another 22 months of drinking. I did nothing that I heard in these rooms. I did not have a big book. I did not, no, I take that back. I think I bought a big book, but I never opened it up. I never got a sponsor. I went to meetings, but I would drink after the meetings. I was very proud of the fact that I never drank before I went to the meetings. And I could never get more than, as you would guess it, 2 months dry, maybe 3 months dry. I certainly wasn't sober. And then something good might happen. And I think, oh, okay, I'm not an alcoholic. Something's good. Look what I made happen. So there I am, dry and miserable, thinking I made things happen. However, somewhere along the line, I found a counselor. I got a counselor, and he was connected with Grand Hospital. This guy's name was Vic Turner. Vic Turner saved my life. Although I couldn't stay sober, and I would go back to him and say, Vic, I had to pick up another white chip. And he said, what happened this time? And I would tell him the truth, and sometimes I had no idea what happened. I just took a drink. That's the default, we all know, of an alcoholic. But this counselor, this Vic, saved my life. And against his group's advice, he would keep treating me, even though I would come back to him after a drink. They told him to get rid of me, and he wouldn't. He just kept on trying to help me. Somewhere along the line, I'm going to talk about two pivot points. And one of the pivot points is this. I'm drunk. It's Tuesday afternoon. I'm on the back porch of this house I bought on the near north side of Chicago. I thought I needed roots, and I thought I had always rented, even when Diane and I were living together, I had always rented, and my parents always owned a home. So I thought what was wrong with me is I needed roots. I needed to own something. I needed responsibility. I bought a house, and as you would guess, that didn't change a thing. But I'm on the back porch of this house drunk in the afternoon of a Tuesday, didn't go to work, or maybe I went to work that morning, came home and drank at lunchtime and couldn't get back to work. But anyway, two women, friends of mine, walked around the side of the house and came up on the porch and looked at me and said, what's wrong, Dan? And I said, because I told them I was drunk. They could obviously see that. These two women weren't part of the program at all. And they said a phrase that we hear in these rooms, you don't have to live like this. And I said, what should I do? And they said, we understand you've been going to AA. Go back to AA. That triggered something in me. I called Vic Turner, very busy guy, always had a full appointment book. I asked Vic if he could see me. I needed help. An hour later, I was in his office. He made room for me. He wanted me to go into Grant Hospital that night. I had to do two things, or I had to do something. And that was I had to share that I couldn't drink anymore, that I was an alcoholic. You see, for those 22 months, I didn't share with anybody that I was going to AA, anybody in my family, that I was going to AA. So I called my parents who lived up in Evanston, a suburb north of Chicago, if I could come up and see them. And of course. So I went up and I shared with them that I was an alcoholic. They didn't really understand that at all. They didn't know anything about AA, but they supported me. And they said, sure. And then I had to go and share with my sister and her husband, very close to me, that I was an alcoholic. And after I shared with those two couples, I drove back to Chicago like I had taken a ton of bricks off my back. I felt lighthearted. I went home, drank that night, drank the next morning, and walked over to Grant Hospital and haven't had a drink since. It's not because of anything I did. It's because of what I learned in that hospital, because of sharing with people like you guys. And it's because of my God, this God that was in the back of my mind ever since I went to that Labor Day meeting 22 months before then. So I'm in rehab. They affectionately referred to it in Grant Hospital as 5 East because it was up on the fifth floor of this hospital. And I went into it and I arrived there with a briefcase and they looked at me and they took the briefcase away. They probably smelled my breath too. They ushered me in and I started a 21-day program. That's what my insurance would pay for at the time, 21 days. They also gave me phone privileges in 5 days. And I found out that they thought that with my briefcase, of course, they thought there was booze in it, drugs. They opened it up and there was just business stuff in it. They thought I had come in there to get a break from business. And they also thought that I needed a little more discipline than the rest of the inmates there. And they said 5 days for me before I got phone privileges. I found out everybody else got it in 3 days. So anyway, I'm in this rehab and I'm there maybe a week and I'm starting to feel a little better. And I think I overreacted. And I'm about ready that night to go down the fire escape in what they call AMA, Against Medical Advice. And that hospital was very much involved with the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what their rehab program was. They had alcoholics come in every night to act as counselors with people. And I sat down with a guy named Ollie, an asphalt contractor, rough as a cob. But Ollie, and this is my second pivot point, Ollie sat with me and I shared with him that I was going to go down the fire escape. And Ollie talked to me about not leaving before the miracle happened, something I had never heard before, but I've heard a lot since. Don't leave before the miracle happens. And I had about 2 more weeks to go on my stay there. And he said, you can do anything for 2 more weeks. Stay here. And afterwards, you can drink. But don't leave before the miracle happens. And that's what I did. So I went from going AMA. And 2 weeks later, I'm scared to death to leave there. They had to starve me out. They didn't send lunch up to me when my program was finished. I was crying. And I packed my bag and I was ready to go. And I had no idea whether I was going to make it because my AMO was slipping and sliding the easy way, this easier, softer way. I ran into a counselor named Jim. Jim asked me what was wrong and I told him. He gave me a big hug and then he turned me around and he pointed me to look out a window. And then we looked out over downtown Chicago and he said, Dan, nothing has changed out there. All the bars are the same. All the women are the same. All your drinking buddies are the same. Nothing has changed out there. But hopefully you have in your 3 weeks in here. And you're leaving here with a tool bag. And in that tool bag are tools that we've given you. And if you take them out and use them, you'll be able to stay sober. And he started talking about these things. He talked about getting a sponsor. He talked about reading the big book. He talked about going to a meeting that night. They were an antabuse program. And he said, if you take your antabuse through the entirety of it, it'll help. We never got the percentage, I don't think, up over 50%. So as a betting guy, you'd probably guess it wasn't too good. But in here, I learned about the fact that I had an allergy, that I wasn't a bad guy, that I was a guy with an allergy. I had an illness, and that took some response or took some bricks off my backpack. They told me how I could behave once I get out, how I could live a sober life. And all those things helped me. I went home that night, went to a meeting, and went to a meeting every day. Oh, one of the other things they said, go to a meeting every day for 90 days. Never heard of that before, but I did as they said. Went back to work. I thought people would wonder where I was for 21 days. Good thing for my humility. No one ever even asked where I was except my secretary, and I told her the truth. And going to these meetings, my MO was I drank around the clock. In my latter probably 5 years of drinking, I drank in the morning to go to work, and sometimes I wouldn't. I drank at noontime. Sometimes I wouldn't go back to work. And I would get this feeling in my stomach coming up to about 11 o'clock in the morning that I had to do something because I was going to drink if I didn't. And I found a meeting downtown Chicago at the Mustard Seed. And I went there. I think it was a 12:30 or 12:15 meeting. I went there with a lunch and learned about AA. But I also learned about the fellowship of the program. I learned that Dan, through my arrogance, thought I was the only one getting sober, the only alcoholic, whatever, you know. And I found that the first word of the first step was we, not me, I. It was we. And I found that in the meeting rooms at the Mustard Seed. I was also told about after the fact of doing the antabuse that I shouldn't take any responsibility for leads or meetings for 1 year. I needed to shut up and sit down and not try to take over anything. They also told me the person I had picked to do my antabuse was our company nurse. They said, that's no good. You have control over her. Pick someone else. So I picked someone else. Inconvenient, but I picked someone else. I did what I was told, and I shared with people that I was an alcoholic and that I was scared. And I think I was scared for many years. But gradually, I got to meetings and I did meetings. I had meetings in buses and ships and airplanes and hotel lobbies. Started a meeting at a show that we had at this warehouse or hardware group that I worked for. We would have two shows a year. People, a couple thousand people would come in. We started having meetings there at noontime. We turned into going from one meeting a week to four meetings a week. We get 50 people, whoever could fit into our director's room, both members and salespeople. I just fell in love with AA and I started doing everything I was asked to do. I had this sponsor, same guy that I didn't like, as you would probably guess, guy that was no good 2 years before. He was good now. He had a good program for me. I did all these things and, I went to meetings everywhere. I would do things both program wise and not program wise. I went to Hazelden a couple times a year for retreats. We'd order organized carpools from Chicago to drive up there to Minnesota. Did everything I could to stay sober because I wanted it more than anything else. And when you do that, good things happen. Not all the material. And I'll get into that, but some of the material good things is that I progressed in my company and ended up being the head of it. I got to say, and full disclosure, that my father started this company, so that I had a little there, but I also had to earn it because I was a 22-year sober employee for them, and also this my race car. Love continued on, and after a few years of sobriety, I found the best mechanic in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was looking for a job. I talked to him. We formed a team and ran an Indianapolis team for 7 years, and we won the Indianapolis 500 in 1983. I tell not to boast, but to say that I also learned that I could say no, that no is a complete sentence. in AA. After this race, we had our sponsor was Texaco, and the chairman of Texaco and his very glamorous wife found me sitting in my garage, or the garage of the car, up on the workbench, and I don't know, probably had a Coke in my hand, and he had champagne, and he came in with a couple of glasses, and he wanted me to toast our victory. I said, thank you, but I don't drink. That was all. He accepted that, but I had to be able to have the ability to say no. As I said, I progressed in my job. But the more important thing is I got these daughters back, these daughters that I had abused probably more mentally than anything else, certainly not physically. But these daughters that I drove with drunk so many times, you can't count them on either hand. These daughters that didn't know their father at all, that never went to a rehearsal for ballet or any school plays. But I got my daughters back. I retired at the end of 1999. I was able to find a woman who was not in the program, but went to Al-Anon on my urging for a year before we got married to know what she was getting into. And been married to May now for 24 years. And I love her dearly. It's a gift of this program. May I found at a racetrack. She, at that time, was working for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But the first time I met her, she was working for Goodyear and traveled the globe with Goodyear racing tires. And knows racing and knows when I want to sit down and watch a race now, she sits with me and we understand each other. I moved all over after we retired. I had a farm in Western Illinois for a long time. Then we moved to Mexico because I got a hair up my butt about loving Mexico. We moved there, lived there for, I got to say, all through this, I always went to meetings, always had a sponsor. Even at the farm, I went and did jail meetings every other week at Dixon Correctional, the largest state prison in Illinois. Went there every week and met some lovely, lovely guys. Still correspond with some of them. We moved to Mexico, lived there 5 years, went to meetings. And in Mexico, I found out that I was missing something. I didn't know much about the steps. This great sponsor I had was a lovely man, but he didn't do the steps. And I didn't do the steps, although I read them. But down in Mexico, I ran into a guy, asked me to help him do back to basics. And we did two different turns of back to basics, and that forced me to reading the big book. And it helped me along the line to become more and more in love with AA. After Mexico, we moved to Texas, and there I started sponsoring. And I took people through the big book. Found out Texas wasn't where we belonged. And now I've lived in Virginia with May for 14 years, coming up on 14 years. Virginia AA has enhanced my sobriety more than I can give them credit for. We work the steps, we work the solutions here. We live in the last 11 steps. We started meetings on step 6 and 7. I went back to jail meetings, and with the COVID jail shut down, I started corresponding with jail people. And now have decided that I'm too old for jail, but we've started a meeting in homeless shelters. I'm trying to do whatever I can to make the woodpile a little higher than the way I found it. I try to live in the 12 steps, and when you do that, good things happen. As I said before, not just material things, but things that touch my heart and my being. And I'll close with another story. May and I just came back from California, where my oldest grandson was married. This is a daughter that lives in Anchorage, Alaska, had three children up there. The oldest son, a 28-year-old terrific guy, invited us to this wedding. I never would have been alive for this if I continued drinking, or I never would have been invited because these daughters still would have been estranged from me. But there we were in a wedding where my former wife was involved and the other family was a combined family. And we were able to get together in the same room all at once with total love and great happiness and joy. That's a benefit of being sober and trying to live the 12 steps. Don't leave the 12 steps up on the wall. I had to take them down and wear them every day in my life. I thank you for listening to me. I hope you got something out of it. And I will close with something. You know, maybe I'm old school, but I decided to dress up for this meeting. And I'm wearing a tie. You can't read what's on it, but I'm wearing a tie that says easy does it. This tie is probably 40 years old. Those of you in the meeting that are sartorial connected know that it isn't the wide tie that we have nowadays, but it's my sober tie, and I put it around my neck so I would remember where I am in talking to you guys. Love you.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you so much. What a great message. My name is Jim Carlo. I'm an alcoholic, but your honesty about your self-centeredness with your family was really helpful to me. And you said you did what you were told. That's really all I got to do is do what I'm told. You know, it's so simple. And you also said that you told people you were an alcoholic and you told people you were afraid. You know, and that's something I was capable of saying I was an alcoholic, but I was not capable of telling people I was afraid, even though they knew. I just couldn't get those words out of my mouth. We do have a couple of minutes, and people are welcome to chime in. I want to try and share something real quickly on my screen here. I hope it works. So I had to do a little Googling. If you guys can see that, can you see that picture? Dan, can you recognize that picture?
Oh, yeah.
1983, the year he won the Indy 500, right off of Google.
Yeah, that's not the right model. The number was 5.
Well, either way, it looks like a picture of you, and that's pretty cool.
I love it. Good going.
Yeah, so, you know, that's what I'm doing here with my camera off. I'm researching people on Google. But thank you, Dan. We literally do have three or four minutes if anybody wants to chime in. Certainly, if anyone's struggling with drinking, or if you just want to tell Dan, you know, give him your thoughts or reactions.
Dan, it's John Higgins here. Hi, good morning. How are you? Thank you so much for being with us here this morning. And one thing I really appreciated was you talking about your tie, and you're coming and you're looking presentable. You're looking well-dressed, like you could be going to a meeting or going to Sunday school or to church or whatever, to a formal event. And I appreciate that, because it doesn't even take that much effort, does it really? It just takes a conscious awareness and then to do that action. So I appreciate that so much. And so many of the things you said were obviously right on target with a lot of the things that I've been through and lived through. And I just want to tell you, thank you so much.